We'll see how this works. Greetings once again. Greetings to all of you online. Sorry that you got cut off when we gave the... Sarah can't hear. Is the sound... Can you hear? The sound is just not enough. Sarah?
It's better when you're up close.
Enough?
It's a little bit hard when you're in the back.
Okay. Is this better? Is this better? Better? Yeah? Okay.
We can also.
I did the musician's sound, but.
We can increase the input. Oops.
Okay, so can you hear now? It's better?
Okay.
Yeah, okay, good. And et pour les Français, j'espère que ça, ça va aussi, mais avec les traductions. I forget, I'm speaking English, right?
Yes.
As I said to those who with Claudia and Marjolaine and Joan who met me at my house to come here together, the drawback of not having a center, a fixed place, is that we have to bring everything with us, set everything up, improvise with what we have, that's beautiful. I love that practice. I also acknowledge the disadvantages or the challenges of that. But really, I mean, really, as I was sitting, I just love this practice. And I just love this Sangha. And whatever it takes, whatever it takes, I will do. And I'm grateful that you follow, that you say, okay, I will do that too, whatever it takes. So I'm grateful to all of you for your dedication, your willingness, your enthusiasm to be here today, to be here throughout all the days, whether it's online, whether it's in person, in different places. Deep, deep gratitude for that. And I was thinking how so, you know, in the break, Claudia put a mask on, and her doctor advised her that all winter long she should wear a mask, right? She has health issues, and it, you know, for maybe all of us should do that. Not necessarily for COVID, but for other things too. And it brought back to me the memory of the early, early, early days of the AIDS crisis, which for my generation was really, really earth, you know, it was like COVID, you know, XXL. Changed everything about everything we did and thought and the way we behaved, and it was really dramatic. And in those very early days, so I remember that, you know, it seems crazy now, but we had this kind of prise de confiance, we would say, where it was like, okay, so when you sleep with someone, you're also sleeping with their partners, their other partners. And you're also sleeping with the partners of their partner's partners. And infinite, right? So it was like, oh yeah. It seems crazy now that nobody was really thinking in those terms, but it didn't matter before. Didn't matter, you know? Suddenly, I mean, of course it did matter, but not in this, you know, this was deadly. It became an issue of life and death. And so instead of responding to that as, wow, this amazing interconnection of all of us, how we are intimately connected with the people who are intimately connected with the people who are interconnected and endlessly, like Indra's net, where each jewel reflects all the other jewels, and the reflection of each jewel in this jewel reflects all of the others. Instead of that, in the very, very beginning, it became Haitians. The rumor was that AIDS came from Haiti. This like sounds so weird. Do you remember this, Dale? It's kind of in the very, very beginning. It's like, because like one of the early cases had been in Haiti, and so Haitians became suddenly, stay away from me. And I actually remember, this is crazy too, in these very early days, being at a party in Paris, and there was a Haitian guy there, somebody's friend, you know? And people were kind of like, ooh, you know, maybe I shouldn't get too close, he's gonna spit on me or something, you know? I actually remember that. It seems insane now. And then, so fast forward now, and now we have Donald Trump saying that Haitians are eating the dogs and the cats. Again, we have the other, it just so happens that it's Haiti, but the other, right? Instead of seeing what we share, or even having compassion. Okay, so say it is a disease that comes from Haiti. Having compassion for the people in Haiti. Of course, it did not come from Haiti, but that was the rumor. And then when it, like, you know, spread like deadly wildflower through the gay community, nobody cared about the gay community. Everybody was like, ooh, get away from the gay people. And then the drug addicts. And then some other people, like, you know, Arthur Ashe got AIDS from a blood transfusion and died. Magic Johnson got AIDS, never really clear where that came from, but, you know, these celebrities that they weren't gay and they weren't drug addicts and they got AIDS. Uh-oh. The gay community rose up and took care of their own, which was amazing. And then others started joining. And, you know, like Bernie Glassman started a hospice for people with AIDS. Bernie Glassman was not gay. He was not a drug addict. I don't think anyone in his family had AIDS. And yet the community in which he lived was ravaged by the AIDS epidemic. So he looked around and he took care of these people. Well, the vast majority, you know, the governments were not doing anything. Famously not doing anything until they couldn't not do anything anymore. So this memory came back to me, and I was thinking about this interconnection, that our world has become even more and more and more and more connected, of course. Or it's not that we're more connected, but the ways in which we are connected have become more and more obvious. And, you know, if we think about it, we are, you know, we're all part of one global communication network. We all are part of one global ecological environment. We're all part of one global political and economic system, actually. And yet we think of ourselves as being separate, of not being, and we don't see the interconnection. When we're sitting here, connected with people in the south of France, in London, in a suburb north of Paris, we've all come from various places. So we're sitting here, we're all breathing the same air, and yet we're sharing everything that we have shared with all the people we've been with before here. We're sharing this space with the kiné who are down the hall. We're sharing the space with the people who pass here. We're sharing the space with the Tony and Guy hair salon. We're sharing the space with the people who live above and across and next door and down the street and the Génie de la Bastille. And we're sharing all of this, all sharing it. And yet we don't pay any attention to anybody except whoever we're like really interested in, who we are paying attention to, let's say. We focus on just this, on our community, the person in front of me, my family, the people I like, the people who I think are like me. Well, actually, we are all like everyone. We're like that guy who walked by with his crutches. We're him. We're him. We don't manifest as him, but we are one and the same. And when we forget this, then we open the gates of hate, violence, discrimination, exploitation, suffering, basically. So I was thinking of this, and so during the break, I wrote down I looked up this koan that I like, and thought maybe we could look at it. So it's from the collection that's called the Shoyu Roku. It's the Book of Serenity or Equanimity. And it's a collection that we use quite late in our practice, but the koans are as beautiful as all the others. So this is case number 4 in this collection. The title is The World Honored One Points to the Earth. The World Honored One is the Buddha. Okay. When the World Honored One was walking with his assembly, he pointed to the ground with his hand and said, "This place is good for building a temple." Sounds like our Sangha, right? This place is good. Let's do it here. Indra, who is, so this is kind of a mythological story too. Indra, who was a great god of Hindu and Buddhist mythology. Indra took a blade of grass and stuck it in the ground and said, "The temple has been built." The World Honored One smiled. So Indra takes a blade of grass. The temple has been built. So what does this say to us about? This speaks directly to our practice. I mean, to our specific wildflower practice, where we do this all the time. We take a blade of grass, we take a basket, we take a few stones, some obscure thing that was on the ground that I just put there. yoga mats, a folding chair, and we say, this is the temple. Because it is. It is. It is the temple. As I always say to you, exactly where you're sitting is the throne of enlightenment. We always talk about this grandiose throne of enlightenment. And even like during the transmission ceremony, we participated in Bart's transmission ceremony. You know, there's a moment when he sits on the throne. So, but you're all sitting on the throne. You're all sitting on the throne of enlightenment, and this is the temple right here. In order to be able to do that, we have to let go. In order to be able to say, this is the temple, we have to let go of our fixed ideas or any ideas we have about what is the temple. You know, a temple, I mean, in Sanskrit, the word was not temple. We could say zendo. We could say stupa. We could say any other word that we want to use as being the sacred space of our practice, something like that. And in order to say, put the blade of grass and say the temple has been built, we have to let go of our idea about where the temple should be, how it should look, what it takes to build it, what materials we need, what shape, how it should be organized. And I've told this story before that Gena Roshi tells of when she and her teacher's Sangha were practicing in Poland. And they would have long 3-month retreats in Poland. And it was in an old ski resort in the mountains in Poland. And so it was huge, so a lot of people could stay there, but it was not an official zendo, right? A Japanese zendo. And at one point, a Japanese monk came who knew Maizumi Roshi, and he came to practice with them, stayed for a month. And at the end of the month, they were very happy to have had him and to show him what their practice and share the practice with him. And they asked him at the end, so, you know, what do you think? Is there anything you could suggest that we could do? You know, anything about our rituals and the way we practice and everything? And he kind of paused and he said, don't change anything. It's all wrong. But in the sense of, it looks nothing like it would look in a temple in Japan. It's not a temple in Japan. It's a temple in a ski resort in Poland, like before the Berlin Wall fell. So this is like communist times, and you know, they had to like struggle to get toilet paper, and they basically ate, what's it called, kasha? Or, it's like sarrasin, like, what is that called? Kasha? We say that? Yeah, I don't know if we see it in English, but anyway. And cabbage. Their meals all the time, that was it, you know. And it was, you know, hard times. And yet, that was a temple. That was a practice. Deep practice with kasha and cabbage at every meal, struggling to get toilet paper, waiting in lines, you know, the whole thing. And the Japanese monk said, don't change a thing. It's all wrong. But all wrong compared to. So we always have, it's a, right and wrong are always compared to. So if, you know, if the Buddha had said, oh no, that blade of grass is not a good blade of grass, get another blade of grass, then we've lost it all, right? The temple has been built right there with that blade of grass. And that's what this wildflower sangha, that's what we do. This is where we find the essence of this practice. That doesn't mean that we can't find the essence of practice in another model. So in at Dana, my original Sangha and my teacher's Sangha, they have another model. They have a room that they use for sitting. It's always in place like that. We use it for other things, like I go there for Qigong classes, but we leave it like the Zendo. We move the altar, but that's it. It's the Zendo. They have everything organized. Everybody knows exactly where things are when they come, and they have their Oriyoki all stored there, and they don't have to figure out how they're going to do in the tea and the coffee and go down the hall. And all. It's all there. It's another model. That's the way they practice. Of course, they also have this model where they pick up in the summer and go somewhere else and do like we do. Although they go the same place all the time, and so it's kind of well entrenched. Bart's teacher, Sangha, Michel Sensei, he has a similar model to Dana, except it's his own house and nobody lives there with him. No students live there with him. So you're actually in his kitchen when you're doing things, and you're in his shower when you shower, and you're in his living room when you're having tea and coffee. And I think Bart is planning a similar kind of model, right? In your house.
Right now, yes.
Yeah. So we use what we can. We use the ingredients that we have at hand. And that is the temple. That is the sacred space. You know, if we were in an official Zendo in Japan, or even, you know, some of, in the West, a lot of the places, I would not have these pillows in front of me and my book sitting next to me. There would be like a specific thing that you put, like a stand that you put your book on, and you would have it a special fabric that you would then unfold and put it on the rostrum. And the Jisha would bring it to me at a specific time, and we would chant before the talk. And then the Jisha would take it away at a certain time. Very elaborate. That's one way of doing it. And those rituals are very important. As we know, we have our rituals that we do here, and they're very important. They help us to better realize the essence of what the whole point is. They help us to let go of our personal ideas. If we all came and said, oh, I think we should sit this long, I think we should sit this way, I think we should do something different, it would just be chaos. So we all agree, okay, we have this format, we sit this way, this is a schedule, you arrive, we say, this is a schedule, and you just do it. You just do it. Because you understand from experience the power of that. The power of letting go your personal stuff and allowing yourself to just go with the impersonal. Because that's what ritual is, it's impersonal. Everyone does the same thing at the same time. We all walk at the same time. We all sit down at the same time. We all more or less sit in the same way, with some modifications according to our specific bodies, which is also important. So if we don't see the specifics, the details, the absolute uniqueness of each one of us, then we can't see the oneness. And if we see the oneness, but we don't see the uniqueness, if we think everyone is the same, then we miss the uniqueness, which is what has happened more or less with our global economic and political systems, is that we try to make everybody do the same thing. We want every country to have the same fast food, the same political systems, same economic systems. We want everyone to be the same. which is tragic, because then we overlook the specificity of each and the beauty and the unique beauty of each. So if we come back to this, so it's interesting that in this koan, Indra is the deity, the god who plants the blade of grass. And it's Indra who has what we call Indra's net, which goes across the entire universe in Hindu and ancient cosmology that has also been adapted by the Buddhist, ancient Buddhist traditions. There, it's this image of a net that goes throughout the entire universe. And each vertex, each connection of the net, at each one is a jewel, which has multi facets. But each jewel is unique, and yet each there's a jewel at each joint of the net, right? And as I mentioned earlier, each one of these jewels reflects all the other jewels. And each of the reflections, as I said, reflects all of the other reflections infinitely. So we can't even get our head around this image of infinity. So it's an image of infinity, of interdependence, interconnection, but it's also an image of uniqueness. Each jewel is unique and reflects all the others with its uniqueness. So, you know, we say a drop of dew reflects the moon in the same way that a lake does. The same reflection, it's just it just appears differently according to the size of the water, or if the water's moving, the size of the water, the shape, a river, a lake, a puddle, a drop of dew, an ocean, the same moon is reflected on that. And yet we need to pay attention to and appreciate the differences of each of those bits of water. Okay. And each of those bodies of water, let's even call a drop of dew a body of water, are the temple. Each is the temple, each is sacred, each is the totality. And yet, it seems separate. It seems different. It is different. And yet, it's one, and it's reflecting in its own way the totality, which is the story of all of us. The story of our Sangha. And I'm saying our Sangha because today is literally 20 years ago today. It's a holiday in Portugal, right? Today? Yeah. And so literally 20 years ago today, we were having our very first retreat in Portugal. It wasn't my retreat. Geno Roshi had been invited to lead a retreat on that holiday weekend, and she brought me with her. I had just received my own transmission only a few months before, and she told the Portuguese people there, I will come for this retreat, but if you want someone else, if you want us to keep bringing this practice here, it's her. Not me, it's her. So they were kind of stuck with me, actually. But there was no obligation after that first retreat to invite me back. There was no, we didn't agree on anything at that moment. That was just the, okay, if you want us to come back, if you want someone to come back with this practice, this is, it'll be her. And they invited me back. And I just, and they kept inviting me back. But it was actually October 5th, 2004, when we were sitting and doing, we probably about this time, I think the 5th was a Tuesday maybe. So we probably were finishing with a circle, you know, finishing the retreat with a circle, which, as I've told the story, we hesitated a long time that morning whether we should do it or not. Having a fixed idea about what the Portuguese would be like and how they would receive it, the practice. Crazy.
I never heard that story.
You didn't hear the story? Yeah. So it was Gena Roshi, me, and Miriam. Miriam, who some many of you know, some of you know, who is part of Dana Sangha and had lived in Portugal after the revolution. She was like one of these, you know, militant young Europeans who came to like join the movement and worked on a collective farm and fell in love with Portugal. Lived there for 5 years, I think. So she was had fixed ideas about Portugal too, because she was basing it on the late 70s. Well, Portugal had changed a lot in those years between the late 70s and 2004. So we all thought, I don't know, we don't know these people, they don't know us. Should we do a circle? You know, it might be too much for them. We kind of had this idea that if it had been in France in a new group like that, it would have been total refusal. The French people would have been like, what are you talking about? I am not going to talk to these people about stuff like this in this way, you know. Again, we had a fixed idea about the French, but, you know. So we were confronted with all our fixed ideas. And so finally, Gena Roshi said, no, let's do it. Let's just do it. So instead of the Dharma talk that last day, so this would have been October 5th, 2004, and she made me introduce it. Okay, so I have to these people we don't know. José Eduardo was there. Those of you who know José Eduardo, he's the only person who's still around who was at that retreat. And so as I say that, those of us who know José Eduardo, we know he loves to talk. So he probably didn't have any problem with the circle whatsoever, but So I had to introduce the circle, and I remember telling them and just sharing what I knew about circles and where it came from and how we do it, and you know, showing them how to sit and saying we could translate and whatever. So we did it, and it was like absolute fabulous, beautiful circle. We suddenly had this awakening of the Portuguese soul or something like that, which came up so beautifully in that circle. So deep and freely sharing, which was nothing like what we would have expected and what we saw. We were thinking of like being like the French, and it wasn't, you know. Absolutely beautiful experience. So you see, we can be confronted with our fixed ideas at any moment. We hesitate because of them. I'm so happy that Gena Roshi did not hesitate, that she said, no, let's just do it. She trusted her instinct and she said, let's just do it. But you explained it, Amy. So, okay. So can we see where, if we come back to our koan, where the Buddha stops and says, let's do it here. If he had been caught by his fixed ideas of it has to be on, you know, a sacred mountain, it has to be facing a certain direction. It has, of course, we know from the Buddha's stories that that's not how he functioned, right? He was nomadic. He was almost forced to leave places because what he was doing was really radical. He eliminated the caste system within his community, and everyone was wearing, you know, the equivalent of this rakusu that I have, which is made up of bits of fabric that other people donated. And it was challenging the status quo. And so eventually he would stay near a village for a while with his community, and then they would be forced to move on until some local leader would protect them and accept that they stay there until the community didn't want them anymore, and then they went somewhere else. Of course, they also traveled according to the season. So during the rainy season, they would always stop in one place. And then that became this practice of what we call in Japanese an ango, which is 3 months, corresponds to the rainy season, and stopping for 3 months and staying in retreat. But so had the Buddha had been, you know, if he had a fixed idea about where the temple should be, he would have given up right away his practice. Of course, we know he wouldn't have had that fixed idea because that's his practice was about that. His message was about not having fixed ideas, that what causes us our suffering is our attachments. So if we have an attachment to where the stupa should be, we would not put a blade of grass and say that's the stupa. That's the temple, that's the zendo, that's the throne of enlightenment. So you know, so I come back to this rakusu, which I have not worn for a long, long, long time, and which was given to me by the Sangha in 2013, and was made by pieces of fabric that everyone donated. À mon insu. So I was not aware that this was going on, and they were sending packages through the mail and, you know, all kinds of stuff and making this rakusu. So, yeah, I haven't worn this for a very, very long time. And then while we were going through the pictures with Claudia for this, the slideshow that we made for tonight that we will show, there's all these pictures of the making of it, and Anna, who made it, still has this dream of doing a project, the making of, or what does she call it? Something like the rakusu stories or something like that. And wanted to even do like an expo in a gallery, and I was gonna write texts to go with it, and we were gonna use the texts that people wrote about their the pieces they sent. Beautiful project. Well, we have a mini version of that in the slideshow because there's lots of pictures from it. And so it occurred to me, wow, and Claudia had never seen this. She didn't know the story. And I said, yeah, well, I never wear it. And my reasoning for not wearing it was that I said to her was, it's too long, okay? It's very long, right? So, and her reaction was, well, that can be fixed, right? So of course it can be, you know, it can be adjusted, so it's not so long. And so today I thought, no, I'm gonna wear it today. I'm gonna wear it. I used to wear it a lot in a lot of the pictures. I'm wearing it. And then someone else gave me another rakusu and another rakusu and another rakusu. And then, so I just,
the charm of choice.
Exactly. And then I just get into a rut of just wearing the same one all the time. And then, so, and on the back of this, very appropriate, what Geno Roshi wrote, because when you receive a rakusu, then traditionally it's your teacher that writes something on the back of it. And so she wrote on the back of this, a quote that you all have heard since, "The mind creates the abyss, the heart crosses it," which is exactly what we're talking about. So the mind creates the separations. The mind says the temple cannot be here. The mind says that blade of grass is not good. The mind says Haitian people, the mind says, this isn't right practice. The mind says that person is better than that person. But the heart crosses that abyss. Because as we chant in one of the if you were even a hair, if you create even a hair width of separation, you create an abyss. So when he says the mind creates the abyss, it's this, can be just a tiny, tiny little fracture, but that's miles and miles and miles of separation. So, but the heart crosses it. The heart makes no distinctions. Even when it recognizes the distinctions, it brings it together. It joins it. That's what, and this practice is a practice of inclusivity, as I always say. And we are on this part of, if we consider that Zen is a school of Buddhism, which I'm not quite sure that I believe totally, but let's say it is. I mean, it is considered. It is part of the branch of Buddhism that's called Mahayana Buddhism, which means the Maha is great. So great you can't even fathom it. It does not mean better. Does not mean it's the greatest of them all. It means that it's the point or the essence of that school, of that vehicle, as we say, is large, vast, maha, great, 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 so big that nothing is outside it. It's also the way of the heart, the Mahayana way, compassion. Tibetan Buddhism also belongs to that school, where wisdom and compassion are the basic components of the practice. In more traditional Theravada Buddhism, there's not so much focus on compassion and heart. It doesn't mean that it's not there, but it's a completely different way of approaching it. It doesn't mean that the Theravada is like the little vehicle. There's a lot of controversy around this. So we are part of this, we manifest this maha, this greatness. And when we chant that the Buddha way is unsurpassable, it doesn't mean that there's nothing above it. It means that there is nothing other than it. Everything is the Buddha way. That's the maha view of it. Everything is it. The blade of grass is the temple. This place is it, right here, right now. But the heart, it's the heart that recognizes that. The mind sees the distinctions and the differences. The heart makes them all one. And what we consider awakening, enlightenment, is when the wisdom and the heart are one. So wisdom and compassion, we see the compassion is the functioning of wisdom. So wisdom is seeing the oneness, waking up to the oneness, and compassion is in the action of putting into action that wisdom. Of being able to say, here is the temple. It has been built. I mean, the temple's already there. You didn't even need the blade of grass. But because we live in this world of differences, let's say, okay, we did need to show that it's here. So we put a blade of grass there. And Wildflower is about that. And to see that, so again, you know, going through 20 years of photos, it's no secret, we've all gotten older. And it's very clear in the pictures. And we've also grown in the practice. And we've grown in number. And we've grown in so when I say we've grown in the practice, we've grown in how we practice. And yet, from the heart view, the heart, there is no difference from the first picture and the last picture of this 20 years of pictures. It's all one, and the heart is the same. So those who, unfortunately, there aren't so many who were from the early days who are still with us, but they are still with us. As I said on Thursday night, for those of you who heard the talk, they're all still with us. You know, it's like the partners of our partners of our partners of our partners, you know, they're all with us. They're all still here. They too are contaminated by the wildflower virus and manifesting it in their way, whatever it is, whatever they're doing, whatever they have chosen to do other than be here now. They are here now wherever they are. So yeah, when I wrote this koan down, I kind of looked at the what I could say about it, but there isn't really so much to say other than that, you know, this practice of inclusivity is a practice of also of tolerance, patience, openness. So it's like an open non-duality or something, open non-dualism. But with patience and tolerance. And because we are in interaction with others, we need to respect the differences. And that's where ethics will come in. You know, if we look at all these different aspects of practice, of the precepts, say. Because as we know, when we look at the precepts, from the point of view of oneness, there are no precepts. There are no other. There is no other. There's no separation. There's no rules. There's nothing to, no one to abuse or be abused. All is one. However, if we don't see the differences, then, and we cling to the oneness, well, then we're not really practicing oneness. We're stuck on one aspect of reality, and that opens the door to all kinds of abuses if we don't truly see the other, and if we don't truly respect the other's boundaries and the other's positions and the other's feelings, just to be more base, most basic, right? On Thursday, I quoted, so sorry for those of you who were here on Thursday, but I had read this article about a kibbutz in Israel that had been attacked, and a journalist who had written a book about it, who had survived. And in that book, he tells the story of that kibbutz was created in 1953. And in 1956, four couples, young people, because most of the kibbutz were founded by very young people, were going to get married, and one of the couples invited Moshe Dayan, who was the famous military, Israeli military leader, renowned general, invited him to come to the wedding of these four people. And he accepted, he would come. But on the morning of the wedding, a horse came back. People from the kibbutz would take turns keeping guard, and they were on horseback. And the morning of the weddings, a horse came back without the rider, which was an indication that the rider had been killed. And this was only, a kilometer or so from Gaza, which at the time was Gaza already, and it was a refugee camp. And this kibbutz is very near Gaza. And the horse came back without its rider. They managed to find the body. The guy had been killed. Moshe Dayan agreed to come anyway, but he said, there will be no festivities after the wedding, and I will give the funeral oration for the dead person. So they accepted. He came to the wedding, and he, in his discourse, in his talk, he said, do not ignore, you don't have to really look why there is hate and violence directed towards you. You don't need to look far. You just need to see that only like next door to you, a few kilometers away, there are people who are suffering greatly and living in basically an open sewer of destitution and suffering. If you don't acknowledge that, there will be no way out of this violence and hatred. 1956. So here we are 68 years later? Same thing. Same thing is happening. He even said, Moshe Dayan, you have built your paradise right next to their open sewer of devastation. Right? So I mentioned this on Friday because I forget even what I was talking about, but what was I talking about?
Gladness.
What? Gladness. Gladness, yes, gladness, which is still very present, gladness for me. So how can we experience gladness when we're confronted with that situation? Well, the thing is that if it's true gladness, that situation wouldn't exist. If truly you experience this deep love and interconnection and the gladness that arises from that, you would not create such an abyss between you and your neighbors. And we see the consequences of creating that abyss. We see the depth of horror that is created by that, not only in Israel and Gaza, it's like in our own neighborhood, in our own hearts even, right? There are things in ourselves that we don't like and we push away and we ignore. The mind creates that abyss. It makes all those distinctions. But the heart crosses it, and therefore the mind can cross it too. The mind helps the heart to see it. So it's not that the mind is all bad, right? The mind is what, the same mind that awakens is the mind that is ignorant, is in despair. So, but the mind sees the differences. And so it draws the heart's attention to them. But because the heart sees the oneness, it draws the mind's attention to the oneness. Therefore, both are necessary. So Moshe Dayan, who is someone who, was a big time army general, hero of the, I think of the 67 war, wasn't it? The 6 day, wasn't, yeah, something like that, yeah. You know, a great war hero. In 1956, I don't think he was yet a war hero, but I'm sure he was a military man at that time. And he saw what, this was like really, really interesting that he saw already what was ahead and what is still present. I don't know so much else about Moshe Dayan, except that he was a great military hero for the Israelis. And did he go on to become a politician or not? No? Anybody know? He was famous because he wore a patch on his eye. He lost his eye probably in a battle, I don't know.
I think he later on became Minister of Defense.
He did, yeah, that's right. Well, you would know that, yes. Yeah. Bart works in the Dutch Ministry of Defense, which is quite fascinating, as I told at his transmission. You know, we've had a lot of online docusons from his office in the Ministry of Defense. Wonderful.
There was no grass, but it was still.
It was a temple. That's right. That was the temple at that moment. He's not a military man, but he worked. That's where his workplace is, right? So where does that bring us? You know, that brings us to this wild rakusu, you know, to this wild flower, this wild practice we have, which I, again, I just love. But I was only able to pursue this practice and meet each one of you where you are, because the mind was not creating an abyss. Because that's what it is. It's meeting you each where you are, wherever you are, whether it's the Ministry of Defense or in Joa's living room, or in Portugal, in England, in, I'm thinking of all the places I've gone on retreats. You know, I stayed in Sarah's house several times, and we had retreats in her house in London. Wherever it is, I met you where you are, and you met me where you are, and we all meet each other where we are. And in order to do that, the mind, the mind's abyss had to be crossed by the heart. So I can see the time here. Okay. I don't know what time we started, but I think I'll stop now and allow for questions and comments. Sharing of any kind, online as well. If you want to share something, you can. Debbie.
Yeah, Roshi, first of all, thank you for the Moshe Dayan story, because the other night when you told it, I got blanked out at some point, and I heard the beginning and the end. I feel it's kind of a magic moment. I kept thinking, I've got to ask her what happened in that story, because I came back on, the sound came back on at the end of the story, but it didn't make any sense. So I'm delighted to have heard that all the way through, especially as I lived in the area and he was still alive, yeah. And can you show me, can you hold your rakusu or show us up again? Because let me get the thing where you're the, because I didn't, ooh, woo. Yeah, Z. Thank you.
Yeah. And some of you in attendance have a piece of yourself on this rakusu, because you're sensitive, so.
Thank you.
Thank you. I won't turn it around every time someone talks. That was Debbie. Everyone heard. Lisa.
I just wanted to share that if you had been
in a temple, in a formal setting, when I first started, I might not have stayed. And so how appropriateness of our Sangha is for me. And so thank you for pursuing all these years.
Did you hear that? Could you hear it? No. So Lisa said that if in the beginning, if I had been in a temple in a formal setting, she probably would not have stayed. And that so for her, this was how appropriate it was, and she thanked me for having pursued it in this way. And I think probably everyone here is in that situation because we stay with what we have an affinity for. It's not that it's any better or worse than what someone else is doing. It's just that that's what we, that suits us or something.
I have no idea also of what it could be other, you know. I was just looking Zen or meditation and I found you and then I arrived at Joa's place and that was it, you know. I didn't ask any questions of what it could be else.
So I don't know if you heard that, but Christine said that she had no idea about anything, any sort of Zen or what it should be like. And so she just looked on the internet and found it and came to Joa's house, apartment, and that was it. That helps when we don't have any ideas. No fixed ideas? Okay, this is it.
Yeah, I've just realized also, yes, I had no fixed ideas. I had no... Miguel told me about you and Wildflower. I knew meditation by that time. I had done a bit in another setting. Didn't quite appeal to me in some way. So I kind of moved away and then I came back and I was sitting with Miguel and he told me, no, there is this Zen, this is the thing, and there is this teacher and there is this group and there's going to be this retreat. This was in the first half of 2011. There was going to be this retreat in the summer, but I was not actually, I never realized how much I wasn't expecting anything. And it's amazing that I was, I had to buy a tent. I was going to sleep in the tent because it was cheaper. I didn't have a tent. I had to buy one and I had to figure out, okay, what do I need for this? Oh, I need somewhere to sleep in. Okay, I gotta get that. What else do I need? I need, maybe a light would be a good idea. I don't think we had phones with light maybe at that time, or I didn't have one at least. So I don't think I ever realized, as I do now, that there was this step from the 100-foot pole, I guess, you know. I don't know, I just took the step. Thank you all for that. Yes.
We opened the window. Joel?
Merci, Amy, et C'est pour faciliter aussi Adrien pour qu'il fasse la, la traduction dans l'autre sens.
Non. My brain is already good.
Merci pour donc pour ce, tes paroles, Amy, qui m'ont vraiment touché profondément. Toucher mon esprit surtout, des fois c'est le cœur, mais ce matin c'était plutôt l'esprit. Et cette, cette analogie d'interconnexion, de relation, de tout et de rien, d'unité, de diversité m'a vraiment beaucoup parlé. Et aussi c'est la première fois que je ne suis pas particulièrement friand de, des histoires du Bouddha en particulier, donc ce qu'on raconte qui sont de l'histoire de la vie de Bouddha, etc. Mais là, j'ai, pour la première fois, j'ai apprécié et compris comment, il y a 2500 ans, le Bouddha, en fonction de, des pluies, en fonction des gens qu'il croisait, qu'il rencontrait, adaptait sa, la pratique qui était naissante, quoi, et qui après s'est, s'est cristallisée en différents endroits. Et cette idée de saison des pluies et d'ango, c'est vraiment, c'est, j'ai beaucoup apprécié quoi, ce, cette image. Enfin, c'est plus qu'une image, que c'est une réalité qui a vraiment traversé 2500 ans, parce que tout ce qui est dit enfin, par ailleurs sur le Bouddha, il y a des choses vraies, il y a des légendes, il y a des mythes qui sont nécessaires, mais cette idée m'a, m'a beaucoup touché. Merci.
Merci à toi. Je ne sais pas si on va pouvoir traduire ça. Anyone want to try to? Sorry, Sarah, it's like too long to translate. Sorry, okay. She's okay with it. Yeah. It's true that when these stories are, it's always like that, you know, when we can connect something to our own experience, we can understand that you would want to stay in one spot when it's pouring rain every day for 3 months, you know. And it's like a daily experience that we can relate to. And so then suddenly, oh yes, of course, they were like us, you know. And it makes sense in a different way. But there are stories too. You know, there's this, this story of, even in the Zen tradition, we have this thing where when you receive transmission, you become a teacher, you receive a robe and a bowl. That's the traditional thing. And in the Buddha's original community, because he wanted to eliminate the caste system, he asked people when they arrived to take off whatever their robe they were wearing and to basically make a robe out of rags of whatever was available. So they all had these robes that were made of bits and pieces like this. And then that became the monks' robes. So the official people had these robes like that and the unofficial people didn't. And then that became like now in the Zen tradition, you know, so monks wear these special robes that are made up of little pieces of fabric, not that they've begged for or that are rags, but some kind of special fabric. And then when you become a teacher, it's even a special collar like this, you know, and it's made out of special, you know, exclusive fabric. Silk or something of a special color. But originally that's not what it was. It was just use what we have here to make some robes so that everybody wears the same thing. And there is a story of the Buddha's first successor, Mahakashapa, who was a very wealthy businessman and wanted to join the community and practice with the Buddha. And so the Buddha's first thing, you know, he said, okay, so if you want to do that, so let's exchange robes. So he asked Mahakashapa to take off his beautiful, luxurious robe, gave it to the Buddha, and the Buddha gave him his rags, basically, and in exchange. Well, after the Buddha died, Mahakashapa said, the Buddha gave me his robe. I'm the legitimate successor. I'm simplifying the story a bit, but there is some truth to it, you know. He was a leader of the community, but there were different factions in the community, and his faction won out in the community, in part because he had this story, oh, the Buddha gave him his robe. Okay, you know. And so now, from generation after generation, the teacher gives the student a robe that indicates that they're the successor.
That the student has to fabric himself.
Well,
is there something like that?
That's new, yeah, that's new. I did not make my own robe. I did not make mine. Joa made his. Partly because we don't have any robes anymore to give. So you would have to like order it from Japan or have somebody else make it or something. So some people have made their own, yeah. So you see what we do with these stories that actually start with just some, you know, it could, so then we, you know, Wildflower could make this thing where, oh, you know, the teachers, their students all have to make them a rakusu out of rags and bits and pieces that they found and make a big story about it, when it's not, it's just that's the story. And what do we make of it? You know, we turn it into something it's not. Mahakashapa got the robe of the Buddha. Yes, because the Buddha was trying to give him a teaching. Mm-hmm. Give up your fancy robe and take my rags. Or, you know, there's that story of Suzuki Roshi, who traveling with his militantly vegan disciple, the guy just like talks all the time, 2 hours in the car, about how the whole community should be vegan and it's bad to eat meat and whatever. So they stopped for lunch. And the only place they could find was like this little diner in a small town in California. And the guy was kind of nervous, the disciple, because there wasn't so much he could eat. The only thing he could find on the menu was a grilled cheese sandwich, which is kind of like a croque monsieur without the ham, right? And that was the only thing he could find to eat on the menu. And Suzuki Roshi ordered this big burger and fries. And his disciple was a little, wow, that's unbelievable that he's doing that, you know? They sit down and Suzuki Roshi takes a bite out of his burger and he said, this is really good. And the guy takes a bit out of his sandwich and Suzuki said, how is yours? And he said, it's really good. Yeah, it's good. And Suzuki Roshi said, can I try? And the guy said, okay, yeah, sure. And gives him a bite of his sandwich. And Suzuki said, yours is better. Let's switch. Teaching, huh? We've already had this conversation. We already talked about this story. I think it was 2 years ago in retreat, wasn't it? When we had a big thing about it. The point is not about eating meat or not eating meat or whatever. It's about our attachments to whatever it is. What?
How the story is about.
Yes.
I don't know, it's like, I knew that story, you know, I knew that story, and this summer something happened to me. I didn't eat meat for like the last 30 years. And because I don't like it, I don't know exactly why I don't eat meat, but I don't eat meat. And I went to see Adrien playing music in La Drôme. And so I was so excited by to be there. It was so crazy to be in La Drôme, watching a concert with Adrien singing. I was in, like, in a, I don't know, it was a very joyful moment. And I was with two friends,
And they were like, I was so proud because I knew the guy who was singing, and my two friends, my two girlfriends, they were like, oh, so you know him? Yeah, that's my friend, you know. So it was like a very joyful night. And we went to the, there was a food truck. And I went to the food truck and it was written, okay, vegan. No, I don't know what was written exactly, but it was like, you could have like the burger, vegan burger, or the classic burger. But after you had to make a choice of the flavor of the burger. And I don't know why, it was like goat cheese. So it was the goat cheeseburger. So for me, it was a fake burger. It was goat cheese, you know. So I ordered this sandwich, and the other girl, she was like looking at me very weird. She was like, but she was thinking, but I thought you were vegan. So I thought she was talking about goat cheese, you know. So I was eating my sandwich, and I was like, it tastes meat. This sandwich, this goat cheese tastes meat. And I was, no, it's not meat, it's goat cheese. So I ate my sandwich, and the whole way of the sandwich, I was like, it tastes meat. But it's not meat because it's goat cheese. And at the end, I said, at the end of the sandwich, I said to my friend, yeah, but I was watching Adrian, so I was so, I couldn't think of my sandwich, but but at the end, I said to my friend, wow, you know what, it's weird, it tastes, this goat cheese burger tastes meat. She said, Claudia, I took the vegan one, but you took a real burger, my friend, you just ate meat. I was like, I didn't eat meat, I ate goat cheese. She said, no, you ate, you. Okay, that was the whole story. And my brain, the whole way my brain was saying, wow, it's meat. I was like, it's not meat. Okay, so you know why I ate meat, like 2 months ago. So now, when, you know, I know by heart this story. And every time I'm thinking of the story, it's not easy to eat meat, you know? Okay, but I ate some.
We don't know if the guy in the story ate it.
Okay, I ate it. I'm telling you, I ate it. But
telling yourself.
But Adrian was singing.
It's his fault.
I look like a goat.
Okay, so that's my story of meat.
So, thank you. I think we should probably stop now. I don't know when we started, and I don't know when we're supposed to end, but I think we said 1:15 we would end, no? Yeah. So I think we'll stop now. Shall we do the four vows? And I guess we're doing them in French, because that's what we have.
When are we meeting again? What's the next rendezvous?
So, is it...
2:30? I mean...
Is that enough time, 2:30?
1 hour break is enough.
1 hour and 15?
To evening. Okay, so...
So, at maybe...
2:45.
Yeah. So, 14:45.
Okay, thank you.
2:45. 2:45. Okay, and I guess it's this link. Is this the same link as usual? Lisa?
Same link.
Okay. Thank you. We're doing the vows. Yeah.
Inépuisable sont mes illusions, je Je fais le vœu de les sauver tous. Inépuisables sont les illusions. Je fais le vœu d'y mettre fin. Sans limite est la réalité. Je fais le vœu de la voie insurpassable, la voie du Bouddha. Je fais le vœu de l'incarner. Innombrables sont les êtres vivants. Je fais le vœu de les sauver tous. Inépuisables sont les illusions. Je fais le vœu d'y mettre fin. Sans limite est la réalité. Je fais le vœu de la voie insurpassable, la voie du Bouddha. Je fais le vœu de l'incarné.
Okay. So, lunch? C'était déjà
non, non. Thank you.
Just
there, it's still, yeah.